all con men. He had taken his deceased father's name in the game. He had taken his father's reputation. He was better than his father ever dreamed of being. His father ran grifts out of pool halls in North Hollywood, credit card scams, rent scams. But scams the younger went bigger. His long-deceased Ecuadorian father would be proud of all scams had done. Of all the children his father had created, scams had been the one who had garnered the most success. He had even seduced his father's favorite concubine. He was a child when his father had Arizona in his bed, and now he had her, and her sister, the same as it had been with his father. He knew his father was in his grave, laughing. His son had conquered Arizona. His father had summed up life in two words, pussy and money. Whoever had one had access to the other. The man who had taken the name Scams had been at sea since he left Colonia, Uruguay. He had brought the dead body of Arizona's brother on board, had done the same with Arizona's almost dead sister. Arizona was wounded, her face scarred up and bloodied, in no shape to do anything but lie on a bed and suffer as she cried and mourned. Scams had left Gideon and his friends in Uruguay. He hoped they had been found and were dead. Nothing would upset Arizona more. Nothing would please Scams more. He had won the battle. He was safe. He was a long way from Buenos Aires. The point of being at sea was to be able to see danger before it arrived. His men were paid to be on guard, especially at night. Without city lights, the ocean offered nothing but darkness. The night also made it even harder to judge speed. On the open sea, it felt like the recreational vehicle wasn't moving fast. Not until something fell overboard could you use your eyes to judge the speed of a ship by how quickly something or someone faded into the distance. But seeing someone fall overboard and fight to stay alive was terrifying. It made grown men scream. And that was what happened when a harpoon appeared in the chest of a guard at the yacht's stern. Only after he fell, the waters swallowed his scream. The splash was hardly noticeable. Seconds later, one of the patrolling bodyguards spotted people boarding. Scams' guard called out, and they fired at him. The enemy's weapons had suppressors. The guard fired his AR-15 back, and that sounded the alarm. He screamed out to the others. Shots came at them from the darkness that reached out from the bow. Not until then did the protectors of the Scams organization see how this had happened. A small ship was in the water, right under their noses. It was dark, reflected no light, and had little water resistance, and its hull was propped up on two narrow struts. The struts made the ship look like it was standing on legs. It resembled a plane and moved like an aircraft on the sea. It was called a ghost. A fast-attack stealth boat with low radar and heat signature, jet propulsion. They wouldn't be able to outrun the bitch. The water vehicle was military, made to get soldiers, marines, SEALs, and pissed-off horsemen of the apocalypse to battle. In the darkness, they had appeared out of nowhere. One of the guards snapped, "They're trying to board aft!" Another fired shots and screamed, "And bow! They're all over the bloody ship!" Chapter 15. Apology for Murder. Gunfire lit up the night, the racket and clamor deafening. Senorita Raven led her team's charge, the albino Tiburon and Kiana Savage at her six.
"Fuck, shoot that bitch! Pop all them motherfuckers!"
The horsemen wore helmets that could stop shrapnel and sniper fire. Four-tube night vision goggles, body armor plates, carried M4 rifles, Sig Sauers, Glocks, and .45-caliber handguns, had M79 grenade launchers and M67 hand grenades, and Daniel Winkler fixed-blade weapons, the Rolls-Royce of blades, Solomon Quest boots, Cry Precision combat uniforms. There were no tailor-made Kevlar-lined Colombian suits tonight. There was no need to dress in a way that didn't terrify the public. One of Scams' guards yelled,
"We're being flanked!"
Another howled in pain.
"I'm hit! I'm hit! I'm hit!
Right there, port side.
I saw two more of them starboard. Is anybody else hit?"
Underneath the stars, as the rain fell, the guards retreated. A set of guards fled past the swimming pool, stopped by the sauna, and returned fire, tried to keep the horsemen from controlling the top deck. The ship's engine stopped, and all went dark on board. The horsemen controlled the engine room. The guards needed to rectify that. Suddenly, an explosion rocked the ship. A bomb had been set off in the engine room. The superyacht was no longer super, just an oversized ship dead in the water. Senorita Raven yelled.
Reloading?
Tiburon shouted.
Moving!
Kiana Savage responded.
Set.
There was no room to perform a bold flanking maneuver, so they pressed on. It was a brute force attack. Close quarters. The stealth part of the operation was over.
Splash in 5 seconds.
5 seconds later, there was another explosion. Scamza's guards were unable to reverse their course, were forced to retreat to the jacuzzi. Smoke bombs hit the deck and obscured everything the shining stars made visible. They were on the top level, a very open area made for lounging and catching sun, clothes optional. This part of the Scams organization was forced from aft to bow on the 20-meter sun deck. They lost 4 guards, then fled to the lower decks to regroup. The horsemen hounded their prey, but 2 stayed in case someone was forced to retreat back up the stairs. If it was the horsemen being forced back, they'd have support. If it was the Scams organization, they would be cornered. If a distress call had gone out and a rescue helicopter appeared in the night and tried to make use of the touch-and-go helipad on the foredeck, they were ready for that action, too. Past mistakes had been teaching moments. This had been mapped out. As the guards fought along portside, they were compromised at starboard by Medianoche. Medianoche led Cobra, Clutterbuck, Javeria, and Reyna, guns blazing. A wounded guard called out,
"We need reinforcements!
They're hitting us on 2 levels at once! We can take these arrogant motherfuckers!"
Flash and bang followed the guards, and gunfire from the horsemen kept them retreating forward into the main salon. Bullets destroyed rich woods and carpet and damaged expensive marble. The elevator opened, and 3 members of the crew were gunned down. The superyacht no longer looked like an award-winning house in the Hamptons. The sofas, coffee table, lounge chairs, large television, everything was destroyed. Windows were blown out, and the sea breeze came in strong. Scams's men were forced to hide behind a wall of polished wooden cabinetry that separated the dining area from a section with white leather sofas, reclining chairs, and flat-screen televisions. On the formal table for 12, Scams's half-eaten 5-course dinner was left behind. In the main salon, where that part of the battle was enclosed, the cacophony was deafening. The gunfire, the yells from men paid to protect a grifter, the screams were in an echo chamber. Medianoche reloaded, heard the enemy yelling, each hired gunman telling his ill-prepared comrade they had to do something or they wouldn't survive the fucking onslaught. The intense firefight continued. One of Scams's men was on the floor, holding his ears. Blood covered his hands and painted his face, both of his eardrums ruptured by the concussive force of a flash grenade. He had become a liability and was left behind. They were in full panic, every man for himself. Medianoche double-popped the enemy in the head and moved by him. They came up on more men who had been incapacitated, who clung to their weapons and chose to take shelter from enemy fire. They were bleeding out on the beautiful floor. Horsemen gunned them down. Medianoche moved on, weapon trained, searching for Scams. Behind him, the horsemen double-popped more of the enemy. The horsemen had covered 2 levels of the 157-foot yacht from aft to bow. Medianoche's team met Senorita Raven's team, and they proceeded together. The Scams organization sought protection, scrambled to avoid the hail of bullets. The gunmen from the Scams organization took whatever shelter they could find and returned fire.
I'm blind! I'm blind! There are more of them behind us! Help me! I'm hit!
There would be no escape, no rules, no holds barred. No fucking United Nations setting the limits of war. Senorita Raven called out,
"Surrender, and I promise not to kill you."
"Fuck you! I'm hit! Fuck, 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 I'm hit!"
Guards fled across wood and marble, across luxury meant to entertain. Medianoche said,
"Grenade!"
He tossed one ahead of his squad, and more gunfire followed. Medianoche felt alive. This was where he was the most comfortable. This was where he excelled. He moved better and faster than horsemen who were almost half his age. In his mind, he was still a young man in war, killing for his country, each kill a celebration. Once a man had been in war, the rest of his life was war. The hired guns on board were good, well-armed, as determined as Marines who refused to be taken by Taliban fighters. Trapped at sea, on a ship that had become a floating kill zone, it was life or death, with no chance to catch your breath. Men breathing heavily were all around him. The enemy wouldn't give anyone a minute to aim. It wasn't a game. No one would magically heal if they sat for 5 seconds. No one would spawn like they did in the game Señor Rodriguez used to play. This was real life. Half the men from the scams organization had caught bullets. There was also a crew of 13. Since they were indistinguishable from the enemy, they were shot on sight. Scams hadn't been found. Not yet. The yacht was enormous, plenty of space, many rooms, but it had a limited number of places to hide. The con man was still on board. Scams had fought well on the streets of Buenos Aires. This was different. There would be no car chase. There was no escape. Most of all, there would be no mercy for a pregnant woman. Medianoche wished he had double-popped Arizona the moment he met her. Scams was trapped. Even if he tried to flee the yacht on one of the smaller boats the superyacht carried, it would be futile. If Scams boarded a speedboat, then tried to flee this battle, the horseman left on the Ghost would blow him out of the water. Just as it had detected the superyacht, the radar on their Ghost would detect if a mini-sub left the yacht. The tangos were pursued. Soon, there were more horsemen than tangos. The yacht had been boarded, and now was destined to be overrun. Medianoche was impressed, as impressed as he had been during the skirmish in Buenos Aires. The Scams organization's guards fought bravely, but were eventually overcome. The ship had become a mortuary, rocking with the waves. The two twin cabins on the lower deck, the two queen staterooms, and the VIP stateroom were all secured. Flash and bang were thrown in, followed by turning each room into a shooting gallery. Be it hired gun or crew, they were all terminated. They didn't chance a guard pretending to be a crew member. They wanted no witnesses. With the ship under their control, Medianoche told them to watch their six and go to the spot each had been assigned. He told the other horsemen, "Do your designated tasks. Set the explosives." Señorita Raven went with Medianoche, side by side, weapons drawn. The ship rocked and rolled with the ocean swells. Medianoche stopped at the door of the master suite. Señorita Raven said, "Sure you're okay?" He took a breath, sweat dripping. "I'm good." "He might be armed." "I want him alive." "Is that optional?" "Not optional." Medianoche kicked open the door, and they entered guns high. The superyacht's layout had said the master suite was accessed via the owner's private office. King bed, walk-in wardrobe, entertainment center, jacuzzi tub, and shower. They found Scams in the private office. He was dressed in a white suit. While his men battled, he had changed clothing. He smoked a cigarette that smelled like cloves. He said, "The door was unlocked. There was no need to break it down." Señorita Raven went to Scams, patted him down. While Medianoche kept his weapon trained on Scams, Señorita Raven checked to make sure the elusive con man was alone. Then she checked the cabinets, made sure no weapons were in reach, before she walked back to Scams, stared him down, anger as high as adrenaline. He coolly said, "You must be the lovely Señorita Raven." She treated him to a headbutt. Then she gut-kicked him, tried to break a rib. When he staggered, Medianoche hit him on the chin, and Scams dropped to the floor. Scams said, "I take it you are not here to capitulate. If you are, help me to my feet, and I'll make us all a cuppa while we lay out the policies of your unconditional surrender." Señorita Raven kicked him in the gut once more. "Motherfucker, you think this is a joke?" Medianoche stopped her from kicking him again. Her rage was strong, but controllable. Eyes on Scams, as the ship rocked and rolled, Medianoche said, "Watch my six, XO." Breathing heavily, Senorita Raven moved back to the door, halfway in, halfway out, gun in each hand. Medianoche waited, watched Scams pull himself to his feet again, nose bloodied. The con man straightened his white suit, then looked at the blood on his hands. Medianoche said, "Scams." "Medianoche. So, our paths have crossed again." "They never uncrossed." "Obviously. Attack where your enemies are not prepared. Go to where they do not expect."
"Art of war."
"Of course. If your enemies have advantage, bait them. If they are numerous, prepare for them. If they are strong, avoid them. If they are angry, disturb them. If they are united, separate them."
"What you managed to accomplish in Buenos Aires?"
"You outgunned us, but we outsmarted you."
"A fucking clerisy will never be smarter than my gun."
"I'm a bit curious, Señor Medianoche. May I ask how you located me so expeditiously?"
"Spectrum data from satellites. They used exact Earth to estimate your position."
"Brilliant."
"Still wasn't easy. Didn't know if you were spoofing and hiding outside the EEZ.
"Any particular reason you're here? Need a ride somewhere? Did you sign up for a 3-hour tour? Would you like some caviar, perhaps?"
"We are here to defeat the enemy and avenge the fallen."
"Are you still the Four Horsemen, or did you become the Three Musketeers?"
"We will always be the Four Horsemen, and this is your apocalypse."
"You arrived in a much larger number than anticipated."
Medianoche nodded.
"You had the courage, just needed more firepower."
"Yours was a well-coordinated, concerted sneak attack."
"Did you expect a Hallmark card sent by carrier pigeon or warning shots?"
"Cleverly orchestrated. Tonight your attack was as brutal as it was clever."
Medianoche paused.
"Was the assassin called Gideon, one of your bodyguards?"
"Unfortunately not."
"You decided to stay at sea."
"Oh, I hate being at sea too long. When I am on a ship for a week, I suffer from mal de débarquement tremendously. It's horrible. Disturbs my eyes, ears, and throat. And for days I feel as if I'm still at sea. The persistent rocking, swaying, or bobbing feeling becomes endless."
"You won't have that problem this time."
He smiled.
"I suppose not."
Medianoche adjusted his eye patch.
"We have business to settle."
Scams nodded.
"The Beast? Where is that convivial fellow?"
"He paid the ultimate price."
"Arizona's knife appears to have done more damage than anticipated."
Medianoche shot Scams in his left shoulder. The shot made the British-born grifter grunt, then spin as he fell. He fell hard. Didn't see the shot coming. The pain came after.
"Medianoche, my good man, was that necessary?"
Senorita Raven came back into the room. She pressed her boot against Scams's face, almost stood on his head, tried to press his face into the floor, same as they had done to Arizona on the streets of Buenos Aires. At the same time, Medianoche used his foot, put his weight on Scams's wound. He pressed hard, put all his weight on the injury, and when Scams had screamed enough, Medianoche put his Glock in the center of the con man's head. Upstairs, there was gunfire. Single pops. The sound of horsemen putting bullets in the skulls of the lifeless to make sure they were really dead. There would be no witnesses. Soon, that would include the con man in the room.
Medianoche said, "Where is Arizona?"
"Could you ask this beautiful woman to get her smelly, bloody foot off my head?"
Medianoche nodded. Senorita Raven went back to the door. Scams's pained expression turned hostile.
"Now, what about Arizona?"
"She's on board."
"We parted ways hours after the event was over."
"Pregnant?"
"She gave birth to our precious baby in Buenos Aires."
"Premature and worth a king's fortune."
"You figured it out. Kudos."
"A fake pregnancy."
"Survey says that's the number one answer."
"She had the device we needed hidden in her belly the whole time."
"Oh, we wish we could have seen the look on your face." Scams laughed like he was showing two middle fingers in the face of defeat.
Medianoche raised his foot and stomped down on the bloody wound, then pressed harder than he had before. Scams gritted his teeth, sweated, wanted to howl. Medianoche barked, spit flying.
I figured it out. I fucking figured it out.
Just not in time.
Oh, it's not too late. If I have you, I have the money. I don't need the con woman. But before you take your last breath on this ship, you will tell me where to find that bitch. By the time the horsemen are done with you, you will scream what I want to know, and you will give me the big black guy's info, the Russian's info, and you will give me that gaucho Gideon. Scams heard someone come down the hallway. A broad-shouldered horseman entered, a man who, like Scams, was in his 20s. He had a smile on his face and held surgical blades in his hands. The Butcher. Chapter 16. Kiss tomorrow, goodbye. I wore dull jeans, a worn baseball hat, work boots, a winter coat, and shades. I took to the streets, shadowed a businessman from his job, followed him as he hurried from Señor Dos Pasos and Avenida Presidente Vargas down into the Uruguayana subway station. The stench of sweat, urine, sick, and something that reeked like stale cardboard violated my nostrils. Disillusioned business partners wanted him out of the picture for good, and as I stood on the crowded platform, waiting to shadow him to the killing point, someone crept up behind me, took slow steps. Someone tapped my back and said,
Jean-Claude?
When I turned around, I faced another part of the past. Eyes wide, wearing a blue dress and high heels under her coat, sporting dark lipstick and a darker look of surprise, she repeated in Spanish,
Jean-Claude? It's you. It's you. It's you. It's you.
Angelina Maldonado? Her surprise changed to dislike.
Jean-Claude, it is you.
Once upon a time, I'd gone to the end of the world and done a job for a grifter. When that work was done, I had met a beautiful engineering student who was enrolled at the Universidad Nacional de la Patagonia San Juan Bosco. We had become lovers. She stood in front of me now. I had lived with her for 2 months, had been her lover for almost a season, but it became too heavy and I left one day and never went back. Tears formed in her eyes. She said,
I thought you had died.
All I could say was, Angelina, wow, you look amazing.
You went for a walk one day and, poof, you disappeared.
Her lips turned down, bitter, disappointed, pissed off, like a bride who had been stood up at the altar, surrounded by people, inhaling the staleness of the tunnel, forgetting what I was there to do. I saw the damage that people like me left behind. I had killed her inside. I couldn't tell her that being with her was a liability in my cluttered world, that I had to be cold and walk away because it could have been too much. I couldn't tell her that I'd been trying to earn $1 million to be with another woman, a woman who had long since rejected me. It was pithy, not close to being enough, but all I could say was, sorry if I hurt you.
Why did you leave?
I had to.
Why?
I just had to.
Was it me?
No, it was me. She motioned.
Your face. What happened?
Got mugged.
You have to be careful here. This is nothing like where I grew up.
I've learned to keep to the main streets and not take any shortcuts at night. She wiped her eyes, firmed herself.
Where are you going? On the train?
No, I'm going back to my hotel room.
You're not getting on the next train?
No, the target was next to us. I turned around, gave him my back so he couldn't see my face. Then I asked Angelina, you want to go to a coffee shop and talk? She paused, considered it. I saw memories flash in her eyes, then shook her head and said,
I have to rush home.
The crowd swelled, pushed us closer. I asked, you live here?
Yes. I have lived here since after I graduated from university. You?
Visiting, Have to be at the airport at 4 a.m. I leave on the first flight.
Then back to Quebec?
We'll be heading to Dubai. Then home to Quebec.
I looked for you there.
In Quebec?
In all of Montreal? Couldn't find you.
I don't Facebook.
No, I went to Quebec. About a year later, I looked for your face everywhere. There are many Jean-Claudes in Quebec. I think I met them all. I prayed to God to let me find you and that you were safe. All sorts of crazy things were in my mind. Maybe he was kidnapped. Crazy things.
I had no idea. She took a breath, swallowed. Too close to me. I was beyond uneasy.
You have a family?
No, I'm not married. I have brothers. They are with my mother.
Didn't you tell me your mother was dead? You said you had no siblings.
It's a long story.
Who do you work for?
Independent contractor for the Hanso Foundation.
Never heard of that company. Is it around here?
It is, but it's hard to find. Most people get lost.
Well, I'm glad you are alive. I can let that part of my mind rest.
The train is coming. Shit, look, maybe I can change my flight and stay another day. We can meet later, get drinks and talk. Let me take you to Rio Cenarium, or we can dance the samba at Carioca da Ema, or Club Dos Democraticos. I know you still love to dance. If you want to talk, we can do that at Bip Bip. We can drink, talk, listen to music. It's up to you.
We danced so much when we were together.
At that Irish bar at the end of the world. The sun was out until after 11.
Galway was the Irish bar. El Nótico was the other place we went all the time. The one with the DJ?
Where we could dance and see the lake.
We ended up at both of those places every weekend. We did a lot of hiking, trekking, rowing. We snowskied in Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego. We worked out almost every day. I lost so much weight. After class, I looked forward to seeing you. You were the ideal man for me.
I looked forward to seeing you, too. You taught me how to speak Spanish. You got me started.
We talked about going to so many places together. To the United States, to London, to Canada, to Los Penitentes, on the highway between Santiago and Mendoza in Chile. I had imagined it all. Then, you were gone. People at my church wondered what had happened.
Iglesia de la Merced, your Catholic church.
The things you owned, you left it all behind. When you left, they spread a rumor that you were married and went back home to your wife.
No, I wasn't married.
Was there another woman?
No, I didn't leave you for another woman.
Was it me?
No, it wasn't you. You did nothing wrong.
Some said you were a criminal.
I wasn't on the run from the law.
That is good to know. Then I will feel like less of a fool.
I asked, so can we hook up later tonight?
Hook up?
I don't mean it in that way. Can we meet and chat for a while? She blinked, remembering, then raised her left hand.
I'm married.
Oh.
2 months ago.
You're a newlywed. Congratulations.
Jean-Claude, this... My heart is racing right now. This feels like a dream.
It's real.
We met in Ushuaia. You left, and now I find you in Brazil. Here, in Rio de Janeiro.
The train and the rumble of the people kept me from having to say anything. She hesitated, looked uneasy, then took out a business card, pushed it into my hand. Now she was Angelina Maldonado de Lao de Albuquerque. She paused a moment, as if she expected me to reciprocate and give her my card. She nodded, bit her lip, said,
"Don't change your flight."
It wouldn't be a problem.
Please, don't. I don't need to start to feel angry and confused all over again.
We could meet for lunch tomorrow. I owe you a better explanation. She shook her head.
Well, Jean-Claude, just call me when you have a moment.
I will call you. I'm serious. I should have called a long time ago.
I wish you had. One call would have meant so much.
I will call you. I know I keep saying that. I will. If you don't call, it was nice to see you one more time. This has been both a surprise and awkward for me. For both of us. And since you are the one who left me, it has been more awkward for me than it has been for you. I wish you safe travels.
Her voice had cracked at the end. Tears returned to her eyes. She kissed me on both cheeks, still polite. She said,
Ciao.
I said, Ciao. Then she was rushing, wiping her eyes and moving with the swarm to get on the congested train. I stuffed her card in my coat pocket, then waved goodbye. Out of all the subways and all the towns and all the world, she walked into mine. My target got on the train, unaware. The doors to the train closed. He didn't notice me. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. My best trick was being able to stand in a crowd right next to a target and never be noticed. But I had been noticed by an old lover. As it pulled away, Anyalina stood on the crowded train, stared at me until she couldn't see me anymore. I hurried back up to street level. I made my way around the area, watching my back, using the reflections in glass to see who was behind me, memorized the crowd, made turns, made sure no one else had made the same turns, made sure the hunter wasn't being hunted. I took the Rua Rodolfo Dantas and stopped at Sofa Cafe. There was a craft cafe near the safe house, but I didn't want to go back in that area. Sofa was a small, colorful coffee shop, the owner very attractive, with a smile like a morning sunrise. I sat in a yellow chair at a table for two, had a French press and a sandwich, and looked over what had been sent. The package had included the target's personal information and all of his habits, his routines. He would be on Rua Javier da Silveira later. He slept at his girlfriend's apartment twice a week. I bet that pissed his wife off. Or maybe she didn't care. I picked up a newspaper, flipped the pages as I ate. The news item that made me pause was about a kid. A 14-year-old had been captured. News said the kid was a reluctant hitman for the Mexican cartel. Mexican cartels had become the top source for U.S. meth. He said that he had been forced to work as a hitman. Kill or be killed. El Ponchis, the cloaked one. The kid claimed that he didn't have any parents, had been in the killing business since he was 12. He admitted that he had assassinated at least 7 people at $3,000 a pop. Child assassin. It was like reading about myself, part of my biography in black and white. I nodded. Sending a child out to commit murder was a form of child abuse. The kid was being paraded in front of the news media, his face exposed, his 15 minutes of abuse now international, while everyone who guarded him with guns stood around the diminutive killer with their faces hidden behind masks. If that kid was who he claimed to be, his days would be numbered, despite his age. This business didn't care if you were 8 or 80. Once you were a marked man, death followed. The world would be surprised how many assassins weren't old enough to obtain a driver's license. I had been in the business since I was 7. That had been the first time I picked up a .22 and shot an evil man in the head. When I was a child, I killed a man who was trying to kill my mother. Many days, I had wished that I had let my mother die. But I had done what a child was supposed to do. Protect his mother, right or wrong. And I had killed her aggressor. That man was my father. That was what my mother had told me. But my mother was a woman of many lies. If I carried Catherine to the top of Mount Corcovado and placed her before the statue of Christ the Redeemer, Jesus would close his eyes and turn his back on her. If she touched his feet, the 6 million stone tiles that covered the religious figure would catch fire and fall like fiery rain. My mother had fooled many, but she was no saint. I put the paper down and considered my environs. The Four Horsemen could be in Brazil by now. I might walk out into the streets and get triple popped. The stress kept my heart rate up, kept my paranoia strong. Paranoia kept me alert, and that was what kept me alive. I left the cafe, went into the center of Rio's business district, and found my way to a place where businessmen went to hide from the world from 2 in the afternoon until midnight. I went to Quatro por Quatro. I climbed the narrow stairwell and paid less than $10 U.S. entry fee to get in and see the stunners they had to offer. They took my credit card, the one with the North American name, verified it against my bogus passport, kept the card, then gave me the key to a private locker. Anything I paid for would get charged to the card associated with the key. Women who looked like they should be holding briefcases on deal or no deal walked to and fro, only they were dressed in lingerie. While Brazilian music mixed with music from the USA and the people jammed hard, I went to the locker and undressed. I showered, stood naked, looked at my body. I touched places my skin had met a blade, touched where I'd been shot. My body was a roadmap of trouble. I eased on a white robe and slippers. I felt naked without a loaded Glock at my side, almost as naked as the women who were walking around the building. But my body was a weapon. Two men found four women who looked like movie stars, and right away they were heading upstairs to claim one of the 50 beds. I saw women who reminded me of every woman I'd been with, even as a teen. I saw Arizona. I saw Miki Morioka. I saw Jules Stewart. I saw Lola Mack. I saw Mrs. Jones. I saw the first women I'd slept with. I saw women my mother used to send to my room to please me. I saw three women who looked like Angelina. And I saw Hawks's doppelganger. I'd known women, but no woman was waiting on me anywhere in the world. There was an area with a small stage for women to show off their stripper skills. A well-built Brazilian girl held onto a bar built into the ceiling and did an upside-down Chinese split. Deep brown skin, small waist with an ass that could make Serena and Beyonce bow down. 6 feet tall and wearing 6-inch heels, she was an Amazon come to life. She had a wide smile. That girl stole the attention in this derma. She twirled around the silver pole, was in a jovial mood, kept laughing and flirting, and then she slapped her bottom over and over. With a wide-faced smile, she laughed as she yelled, "I need a man with a big hard dick to fuck me in my ass." There were admirers, but no takers. She made her offer again, laughed at the cowards. Then she was upside down again, holding onto the bar in the ceiling, doing a Chinese split, spinning in circles. She was solid, athletic, blazing like an out-of-control forest fire. She was too beautiful, too fit, and too much for the average man. I searched for that girl from Ipanema. Needed to get the last of Arizona out of my heart. I needed to get Hawks out of my head, too. And running into Angelina had thrown me off. For 2 months, I'd given Angelina the BFE, the boyfriend experience. I'd grown up in brothels, had slept with whores before I was a teen, had learned twice as many ways to please a woman as I knew ways to kill. I'd shown all those ways to Angelina. No, it was deeper than that. Regardless of the name I used, I had been her boyfriend. I'd met her friends. I'd met her family. She had invited me into her life and home. Then, funds had been transferred. There was another job. That night we had sex. The next morning, I went for a walk, and minutes later, I was in the wind. Many days I wished I had stayed, but I knew the end would have been inevitable. I just didn't know when it would end. That was the problem when people in my corrupt world dealt with squares. I walked from room to room in Quattro por Quattro, more comfortable in a place like this than I ever would be in a church. The women knew I was different, not desperate, not afraid. I looked at them like I saw their humanity behind the makeup and heels. I saw daughters, young mothers, girls trying to survive. Paranoia made me check out the place. I needed to make sure I saw everyone except who was doing the up and down in the 50 small bedrooms. Was still tense. Medianoche wasn't in this brothel. The woman called Senorita Raven wouldn't be in this space. To me, she had never been more than a blur. Shotgun had faced her. But if that wicked bitch was here, the way Shotgun described her damaged face, she'd stand out. I opened and closed my hands. They shook, not with fear, but with worry. I had a mother. I didn't like her because I didn't trust her, but that was irrelevant. Like her or not, trust her or not, she was the mother the universe assigned me. By nature or nurture, this was where I was. And I had brothers. Robert and I had different mothers and fathers, but he was just as much my brother as Stephen. Stephen was the name he used, but the name he'd had in London was Andrew Sven. Stephen and Robert both had lived in London's red light district. They had lived on Berwick Street in brothels, in rooms barely big enough to turn around in. Stephen and I had the same mother. Robert's mother had been killed because of me. That blood was on my hands. I owed that boy everything I could possibly give. We were a bunch of misfits and rascals. Stephen had no idea who his father was. I understood how he felt. Robert had no idea who his father was either. He had connected to Shotgun more than he had to me. Shotgun could explain racism to Robert, what to expect, how to handle it, much better than I could. Shotgun had become my best friend. It was my first time having a best friend, and I saw how important it was to have someone to rely on. That was why Robert and Stephen needed each other. I needed them too. They were all I had. I'd find Catherine. I'd see my brothers again. I told myself a bushel of lies, more than I had in a long, long time. When I felt safe, I went back to the main area, moved to the spot where they had the stripper pole and the bar recessed in the low ceiling. I passed Meek Men and faced the dark-skinned girl with the body of all bodies and the Julia Roberts smile. I told the solid Amazon to come down from the stage. She wasn't average, and neither was I. I reached for her hand. I said, "You're beautiful. I would think men would fight to have a second of your time."
"They prefer girls who look European, or girls who look like they are from Spain."
"They're missing out. What's your name?"
"I'm black, and I like to be called black. I'm proud of my beauty and my color."
The magnificence she had to offer was billed at 150 reals, 46 U.S. dollars an hour. She sat with me, chatted while we shared a drink. She smiled a lot, had a nice laugh. She told me her real name was Rohana Carvalho, but she wanted to be called Black. She told me that once she came in those doors, Black was her name. She asked,
"Where are you from?"
"The States."
"American?"
"As far as I know."
"You don't sound American."
"I've been around, travel a lot, for work." I warmed up to her, the best I could warm up to a woman in her profession. She warmed up to me the best she could with a man she'd never seen before. She touched my chin, flirted, made me smile, put me at ease. I decided to patronize the goddess, take her up on her bodacious offer, and see what kind of fun we could have in a room upstairs. Then I would find a plastic bag to put over a man's head and watch him die. Chapter 17. Murder by Contract. After Brazil, I was sent to Iceland. I did what I was paid to do near Hallgrímskirkja church. Then I geared up, put on warm clothing, rain gear, and hiking boots, and carried my lunch. I found road 221 and parked my jeep in the parking lot at Sjölhamirkut Café. I was heading for the Sjölhamirkut Glacier. I picked up ice gear and safety equipment, got ready to hike for the next 4 hours. This felt therapeutic. I moved by ice sculptures, water cauldrons, ridges, and deep crevasses. I was doing this to leave the world. If I had known if Catherine and the boys were safe, I might have stayed on top of that glacial mountain and enjoyed the effects of global warming, or just gone to Reykjavik, used my new name and bogus cards to rent an apartment. Her voice was inside my head, our last shared words. She had snapped like she was Thelma once again.
"What the hell have you done?"
"Did you know he wasn't dead?"
"Why would you find him? Did you fucking know he was alive?"
One hand in a fist, the other with its trigger finger moving over and over, I nodded. There had been anger. There was surprise, but not the kind that outweighed her rage. That wasn't the way a person would react when someone they loathed had been resurrected. She knew. She had known all along. For years, I thought she had been running from me because of what she had done, but she had been running, hiding, from midnight. Now, I had kicked the dirt off his grave and pulled him out of his coffin. Other hikers were in the area, part of their own four-hour tour, all being led by Icelandic mountain guides. In the group were kids as young as 10. I didn't pull my 9mm from my back. I took out a satellite phone and dialed a number that was at least 7,000 miles away from where I stood.
Constantine answered on the first ring, then told me something that made my heart skip a beat. He told me,
Scams is dead.
What happened?
The yacht he had. It exploded. Went down like the Titanic. And it wasn't an accident. The only reason anyone knows is because a cruise ship off in the distance saw fireworks and called it in.
A chill ran through me, and I said, The Four Horsemen tracked him some way.
After what I saw them do in the streets, that's where I'd put my bet.
Scams' body?
Fish food, like everyone else who was on board.
My breath fogged from my mouth.
Arizona and her sister? Sierra?
We left them with Scams.
Assume the worst.
I took a breath, shrugged off a useless emotion.
What's my next job?
You sure you're in shape to move on?
I'm talking mind, not body.
I'm sure. Tell me about the next job. Get me there.
You need rest.
Rest is for the dead. He told me about the next contract. Everything was already in place. The job had been triple verified, so I would know I wasn't being set up. Being sent to where the Four Horsemen wanted me to facilitate an ambush. Then I hung up, stood on the glacier, too stunned to see beauty. This was too much. I needed to be a square, if only for a moment. I needed to be back in the Cayman Islands with an attorney and an actress. I needed to not be Gideon, but Jean-Claude had done as much emotional damage. Guilt rose, and I called Angelina, the Portenia I had met at the end of the world. When she answered, I hung up. I'd broken her heart. I'd seen that leftover pain bringing tears to her eyes. I had nothing to offer a square, but another helping of the same. She'd only been married for 2 months. My mind went back to the place I had tried to free it from in vain. Scams was dead, at the bottom of the sea. And Arizona and her sister were probably consigned to the same sepulcher as well. Both were at Davy Jones' locker with the son of the man who had been their lover. The son was Arizona's lover, too. And he was probably her sister's bedroom bully as well. The hunter was hunting. He was vicious. And he wasn't alone. I took the 9mm from my back as I hiked down, not trusting anyone. Exhausted, I left the land of the Vikings and disembarked in Athens, Greece. It was around 27 degrees Celsius. That made it just a bit more than 81 Fahrenheit. The temperature was going up to 33 on the Celsius scale, so that meant it would be at least 92 degrees Fahrenheit. For days, I'd dressed in boots and trainers, so I changed it up. I put on a single-button gray suit, brown shoes, gray shirt, pink necktie, and frameless glasses, and soon carried a briefcase that had been handed off to me as I cleared customs. I left the international airport looking like a respectable but overworked businessman. The briefcase had good weight. Now I had weapons, 2 Glocks, blades, brass knuckles, and poison. After I visited a rapist who had been on the run from his victims in North America, I went to the safe house, a penthouse in Athens in Devaki Square in the Kalitheia area. I rested a few hours. Then I went to France, where it was just as hot as it had been in Athens. Was there 1 hour before I mixed with sweaty and smelly migrants from Calais. I herded with men desperate to get into London, paid the price, and prepared to be smuggled into the Big Smoke, the place economists were now calling Reykjavik on Thames, in the back of an overpacked lorry. While we were waiting for the lorry to show up, I stepped away and called Shotgun. The man born with the name Alvin White said,
You still alive?
I'm above ground, still on the move. Not sure how far the bastards are behind me, but I know they're trailing me.
If you can smell the dog doo-doo on their shoes, keep moving.
I'd say they are running a day behind me. About to change that. He said,
Heard about Scams, Arizona and her sister. Was worried.
After running a minute or two, anything urgent?
You shouldn't be traveling by yourself.
I'm bad milk for everybody. Shotgun paused again.
You talk to Hawks?
She can take care of herself. She's smarter than all of us combined. Then his worry deepened, and he asked,
No word from Catherine?
I paused. Let's hope for the best.
I'm going to go by there again.
That spot could be hot. Don't go by there. Let her make first contact.
I know all the cars are supposed to be in her cul-de-sac.
This ain't like the trouble I had before, so stay out of that area.
Okay, I understand. But everything is good with you?
Well, I've been back in the gym, been training hard, mixed martial arts and boxing. I'm working on getting stronger. I go out to Woodstock and shoot a 9mm with my shotgun, and I'm still working on my reading. Did the homework Catherine gave me to do, got me a workbook and a CD at Barnes & Noble by Cumberland Mall. I ain't sleeping much, so I keep my mind busy studying. Doing pretty good. I bought a John Grisham book when I was at the airport.
You're reading Grisham already?
Not yet. I bought A Time to Kill. Was going to buy the book The Reader, but my man Samuel Jackson was in the Grisham movie. My goal is to be able to read every word in that book in 6 months.
You can do it.
Then I'm going to buy The Reader and read that. I'm sticking with it. That movie made my wife cry. I'm going to do it like the woman in that film and learn to read. Then my wife won't be the only one reading the bills when they come in the mailbox.
Catherine will be proud. Whenever she comes out of hiding, she will be proud.
No idea where she went.
By now she could be hiding in Switzerland or in an igloo at the North Pole. When I see her again, I want to surprise her. She's really made a difference in my life. She's taken the time, and out of the goodness in her heart, she was teaching me to read.
Make sure you tell her that. She needs to know she's done something positive.
So have you, Gideon.
I had turned a failed heavyweight boxer, an illiterate man who was driving a taxi for a living, into a man who would never see the pearly gates of heaven. But he saw me as a good thing. He had blood on his hands, but he had money in his pockets. He could feed his family. I could have said a lot, but just replied, "Thanks, Alvin. I appreciate that."
I ain't never had this much money at one time.
Spend it bit by bit.
Oh, I know. I finally got my wife under control. Last time she spent it all up real fast.
We laughed like brothers who didn't have a care in the world. He said,
"Never got to say it because we was kind of busy, but I thought being down in Buenos Aires would be like being in the islands."
Not even close.
I thought black people were all down there.
Used to be in the 1800s.
What happened? Where'd they go?
I told him that millions of African slaves had been imported to almost all of Latin America. From what I knew, the Portuguese settlers intermarried with both the Indians and the African slaves. He said,
"Jungle fever been around a long time."
"I guess so." We laughed a little. He said,
"That's messing me up. Being somewhere ain't no black people. I was happy to get off that plane up here in the ATL.
Used to be more than 50 African nations in that area.
For real?
Ungunga, Kisama, Miravi, Manyolo, Minanago, Sabalu.
What happened?
I told him that Africans had been enslaved and put on the front line, sent to fight somebody else's war. Most of them killed while the people who started the war sat back and waited for the outcome. He said,
"Making slaves fight was genocide for the Africans. I bet they tried to kill off my people to make their money. Had no idea."
What the war didn't kill, some say yellow fever put in the ground.
What? Nobody was left?
They think that the surviving Africans got out of Argentina.
Did they leave Argentina to go back to Africa?
They migrated across the river into Uruguay.
I would have kept going until I got to Africa.
They stopped in Brazil. Intermarried. Had babies.
Well, that explains why Brazilian women are shaped like that.
We laughed. Talking to a friend about the things he cared about calmed me. A couple of sentences later, I became serious, told him I would be in touch within the next 48 to 72 hours, but if he hadn't heard from me in 96, to not come looking for me. 11 days had passed since escaping Uruguay. 12 since the battle that had spread across Buenos Aires. They'd found Scams' yacht in less than 2 weeks. I climbed on the truck and kept my eyes on the desperate strangers. Being still gave the exhaustion in my bones time to settle, and the way the truck rocked didn't help my case. I didn't want to, but 30 minutes into the trip, I closed my eyes. Each eyelid weighed a ton. I hadn't planned on sleeping, just needed to stop blinking for a couple of minutes. Sleep captured me, and soon it dragged me into a nightmare. I was back in the Vichas, covered in sewage and mud, and Medianoche was in front of me. It was as it had been. He faced me, holding 2 9mm. The dead bodies of all my friends surrounded me. Scams, Arizona and her brother, Constantine, Shotgun, Hawks, Sierra, the Bajan. I looked at their corpses, and when I raised my eyes to Medianoche, he was no longer alone. The Beast, Señorita Raven, and Rodriguez were at his side. I'd never seen the Beast, so his face wasn't clear, but I knew he looked as powerful as his name. Each horseman carried 2 guns. They raised their guns and fired at the same time. I jerked awake, panting, ready to kill. The immigrants in the truck moved away from me. Some laughed, a nervous laugh. Some called me a madman. I downed a BC powder, ignored them all, and made myself stay awake. I didn't want to see horsemen, not even in my goddamn dreams. Chapter 18. The Tattooed Woman. London was hotter than normal. The heat wave and the great wind was part of global warming. I was on Queen Street in the area for postal code EC4R, near the site of St. Thomas the Apostle Church. A placard said the church had been destroyed in the Great Fire of 1666. The safe house was on the top floor of the Marlin Apartments, over a Domino's Pizza. My window faced Cannon Street. Bicycles were down below. The section of Queen Street that ended at Cannon Street was blocked off to through traffic, only allowed pedestrians. I needed to know all of that, in case I had to leave in a hurry, had to chase or was being pursued. In the land of red phone booths, I stood at the window eating a mayonnaise-thick seafood sandwich from Sainsbury's, binoculars in my right hand, wearing dungarees and a plain white t-shirt. There was an iPad that picked up the feed from the CCTV cameras right outside the building. I used the binoculars to see what the cameras didn't show. CCTV cameras had blind spots. The television was on. The screen showed me what was in the lobby of the building, let me see who entered, and showed me what was going on in the hallway outside of my door. I took another bite of my seafood sandwich. Nasty, but not nasty enough to toss. The Brits put mayo fucking nays on everything. Might even be in the water. I watched the massive crowd trudge toward St. Paul's Cathedral and in the opposite direction toward London Bridge. For the last hour, there had been so many professionals walking in the heat, I thought a white-collar protest was going on. Double-decker buses were packed to the windows. People looked miserable and murderous. Something bad had happened. But no one was running, no one was panicked, so they weren't reliving the terrorist bombing of 7/7. At the appointed time, my contact appeared in London's financial center. She came from the direction of the restaurant, Ty Square. She had 2 backpacks. She carried a black one, but she wore a heavy Arsenal backpack that had a red teddy bear hanging from its strap. She came down one of the mews leading to the Mansion House tube. Constantine had told me to expect a young Hindu woman sporting an aquamarine mohawk. As she passed the row of bicycles, someone on the crowded mews bumped into her and she snapped, said something harsh,